without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. It's time for him to tweet again. But first he'll have to check in with Fox News, 'cause that's the only place he gets his views. And that's how things get planted in his brain, where they remain. And it confounds the science. The problem is he's not alone. He tweets to people on his phone that global warming is a giant hoax, perpetuated by the liberal folks. And he hires people that all think the same, that play his game. And it confounds science. When he talks to crowds of four, he sees 10,000, maybe more, believing they all think he's God on earth and was the product of a virgin birth. And if you disagree, you're the victim of fake news or feminist truth. Says he, you do not know. It makes me smart from so much dough. I know exactly where the problems are, but his solutions are beyond bizarre. 'Cause his words never quite a sentence make, and thus he spake. And it confounds science. No limits on pollution now. There's not a thing we don't allow. Dump the garbage in the waterway. Spray the toxins where your children play. All the signs say that life on the planet is headed for.
It confounds the science. Ah, yes. You know, it took me a long time to find out who was behind that wonderful Simon and Garfunkel song parody, Confounds the Science. Perfect. It's sad and funny at the same time. That's not an easy feat to accomplish. There's a website called, before I get it wrong, Parody Project. It's parodyproject.com, and they do these song parodies. And I've got to tell you, in this one, Confounds the Science, the guy who is the Art Garfunkel guy looks exactly like Howard Stern. It's kind of disconcerting. just thought I'd throw that out there if you do go. I haven't had a chance to peruse all the different songs that they parody on here, but I found a new source of things that I can open the show with that are kind of funny, sometimes a little sad and funny. But today, I got to tell you, we're kind of in a good mood because we have some good news to share with you.
Tell me something good.
Good news blowing in your window.
It should come up good.
Good news is knocking on your door.
Good, 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 good.
Good news, good news, good news.
Well, it's good news for me because I live in Florida. And as you know, I've referred to this state as Florida for a long, long time.
Boy,
yeah, because Florida does really duh things. Like, you know, electing Rick Scott, the guy who was responsible for the largest fraud of Medicare in our nation's history. The people of Florida elected him governor not just once, but twice. And now they've nominated him to be the Republican candidate for senator. But this time, Florida lost. Andrew Gillum, who I've been telling you about, I've been trying to get on the show unsuccessfully, but now I'll redouble my efforts again. Andrew Gillum had a surprise upset and came out on top. He beat Gwen Graham, the prodigal daughter. You know, she's the daughter of former governor and popular governor and senator Bob Graham at that. Only, you know, just like we always say, Andrew Cuomo is no Mario Cuomo. Well, Gwen Graham is no Bob Graham. Her record in her one term in Congress was abysmal. She voted with the Republicans most of the time. She was not a progressive by any means and barely a Democrat. And we had such a really abysmal slate of candidates. I mean, there was Gwen Graham. There was Philip Levine, the very ambitious former mayor of Miami Beach, who always loved seeing his name in print. I never followed the story, but Boca Brittany Summers always told me there were some weird Russian connections with Levine. And what's really weird is his sister was a friend of mine in high school. He followed me by 3 years at Hollywood Hills High School. I don't remember. I'll have to ask my sister if she remembers him. Philip Levine. Never mind, though, because he placed third. We had, what's her name? Gwen Graham came in second. Then the other people, what's his name? How quickly we forget. Jeff Green, a guy who spent zillions of dollars. Okay, not literally zillions, but millions. I did have the, where is the, hold on. I had all the numbers. Let me see if I can't. My computer is being really squirrely, and I restarted it and everything. Come on, computer. I hate it when this happens. I think Chrome did something. Is anyone else having problems with Chrome these days? All right. It freezes up on me. All right. So where did I? Okay, here it is. How much money they spent. So you had Philip Levine leading the pack, spending $37.7 million. I knew the guy was rich, but that's ridiculous. $37.7 million Philip Levine spent for his third place showing in the Florida Democratic gubernatorial race primary. Jeff Green came in second. With $34.7 million. Jeff Green, a billionaire, who I guess made his money in credit default swaps. Nice guy. He's also a member of Mar-a-Lago, who claims to have, you know, fought back against Trump. But there are I think it was Philip Levine, read an ad ad nauseum that showed Jeff Green calling Donald Trump, you know, a great guy. And he's with him all the way. So there was Philip Levine, Jeff Green, Gwen Graham. Gwen Graham, okay, she spent $16.3 million. Now, that's a lot of money. Maybe not when you put it next to $34.7 or $37.7 million, but $16.3 million on a primary race for governor. A guy named Chris King, who I couldn't tell you the first thing about, spent $7.8 million. I don't even know where he showed up. And then there's Andrew Gillum, $6.6 million. We didn't see many TV ads. I think I saw two, seriously. He had, you know, but he what he did have was the support of all the progressive groups, from bold progressives, you know, the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, to Democracy for America, to Move On, to People for the American Way. Of course, our friends at Blue America, every single progressive group was out there working hard for Andrew Gillum. And that's how you get it done in a grassroots manner. Andrew Gillum, who nobody saw coming. And we were watching the numbers, and there was like him and Gwen Graham sort of fighting it out. First he was in third place, then he moved up to second. And then he and Gwen Graham kept going back and forth by just like a few votes, like less than 100 votes. And then I went in and I took a shower. And then I came out and I turned it on again, and he was in the lead. And then I had to turn it off for a while. I was just getting too nervous. So I turned on... Oh, we were watching something on Hulu. And then I happened to pick up my phone because I heard a little ding that signaled that I got an email. And I saw the news that Andrew Gillum won. He is a true progressive. He is the real deal. And the fact that Florida nominated a real progressive is astounding. But this is what happens when people get motivated to vote. In the last election, the Democrats put up a woman named Alex Sink. She was, you know, a sort of a Democrat name only. She was a Republican light. She was just like the rest of them. And she gave people no reason to come out and vote for her. And they didn't. And we got saddled with a second term of Rick Scott. This time, not only do we have a great candidate to vote for at the top of the ticket, the governor's race is the top race, in Andrew Gillum, we have a real progressive who advocates for Medicare for all, for a $15 an hour minimum wage. I mean, all the things for tuition-free college. I mean, all the progressive ideals. Yes, Bernie Sanders came to Florida to campaign for him. And you know, the scary thing was we're looking at this Senate race with Bill Nelson, who is a lump on a log. He's just good for nothing. He's just there. The only thing I could say is with a D next to his name, at least he gives the Democrats one extra number. But for that reason alone, if you're in Florida, you have to vote for him over Rick Scott, who is a criminal who shouldn't have been in Tallahassee all these years, let alone be sent to Washington as a senator. Are you kidding me? The guy's a crook. So having Andrew Gillum at the top of the ticket will drive, you know, other voters who might not otherwise have been motivated to vote for Bill Nelson to just then vote, you know, the party line down the ballot. So there's good news here in Florida, really good news. This is, really surprising good news. And there was good news actually out of Arizona in their governor's race as well. Now, I don't know as much about the dynamics of what's going on in Arizona, and I don't know anything about David Garcia other than if he wins, he's the Democratic nominee for governor in Arizona. If he wins, he'll be the first Latino governor elected in more than 40 years in Arizona. Overall, a pretty good night. I think we'll talk with Digby a little bit about it, but I'll tell you what, just let's get going and get the rest of the news, shall we? Because I got a lot of it in What's News. So we'll do it live.
I read the news today. Oh,
boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Upset was the word of the day in yesterday's primary for the Democratic nomination for governor in Florida.
This is a shocker. His name is Andrew Gillum. He's the mayor of Tallahassee. He led in no polls coming into tonight. I don't think he was in second place in a single poll coming into tonight. And yet Andrew Gillum is now the Democratic nominee for governor of Florida. He has upset the front runner in this race, Gwen Graham, former congresswoman. This is a famous name in Florida. Her father was a governor, a U.S. senator. what happened. Andrew Gillum, he was endorsed, by the way, what does he represent ideologically? He was endorsed by Bernie Sanders
home
stretch of this campaign. If you can place him a little bit, the mayor of Tallahassee. So what happened, though? A couple things to explain this. Number one, obviously, he did well in his base here, but here, go down to South Florida. What really powered Gillum, Broward County here. You see,
he ran up
the score. This is not his home region in the state, and Gwen Graham did terribly down here. Graham was supposed
to tell you about Broward County.
Do better up by her base. Instead, Gillum just ran up the score here. Also, go down to Miami-Dade. This is Phil Levine, the third candidate in the race. This is his home base. Gillum winning this outright again. Graham finishing very, very distant third there. So Graham got crushed in South Florida here. Gillum did very well down there. He also did very well in Orlando. This is Tampa, Hillsborough County. He's actually going to win that there over Gwen Graham. That wasn't supposed to happen. Big margin for him in Jacksonville. And then how about this? Gwen Graham, this is her home base. This is where that congressional district she represented was, the panhandle there in Florida. She was supposed to run up the score here. You can see this is Gillum's color here, this dark blue. You see some of those counties he won outright. Others he was competitive in. So all around, this is just a shocking performance. And what it does is it sets up a very interesting general election here. This
yes,
is a candidate of the Democratic base, certainly Gillum, an insurgency here. I think you could call that. Who's he going to run against? He is going to run against Donald Trump's endorsed preferred candidate in the Republican, Ron DeSantis, the congressman there. He defeats Adam Putnam, establishment favorite there. The Republican establishment thought Putnam is by far, they felt, by far more electable than DeSantis. DeSantis wins this thing in a runaway. So Democrats are going to look at DeSantis and they're going to say, this is a very vulnerable Republican in a midterm year, in a midterm environment that looks good for Democrats in a state. It's been a long time since a Democrat won here.
And it's about time. So this guy, Ron DeSantis, was a nothing. He was a backbencher congressman. I don't know how many terms he served, probably only one. I had never heard of him before. He's from northern Florida. Before Donald Trump endorsed him out of the blue, the guy he was running against, Adam Putnam, he was in the cabinet before. I think he was the agriculture secretary or one of those kind of things. This guy has been running for the Republican nomination for governor like his whole life. And Trump comes in not knowing anything about the Florida politics and endorses the other guy, who, of course, wins. Now, Ron DeSantis, nobody said he's a brain surgeon or anything. One of the first things he did was open his mouth and insert his foot.
Well, look, I mean, this is Florida elections are always competitive. And, this is a guy who, although he's much too liberal for Florida, I think he's got huge problems with how he's governed Tallahassee. He is an articulate spokesman for those far left views. And he's a charismatic candidate. And, I watched those Democrat debates. None of that was my cup of tea. But, he performed better than the other people there. So we've got to work hard to make sure that we continue Florida going in a good direction. Let's build off the success we've had on Governor Scott. The last thing we need to do is to monkey this up by trying to embrace a socialist agenda.
To what?
With huge tax increases.
Oh, he just said to monkey this up. And yes, if you're thinking this guy sounds a little racist, you'd be correct. The articulate quip, the monkey remark, and there was one more in there that I'm drawing a blank. But wow, not even 20 minutes into his race against the possibly the first African American governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis pulls out the old racist dog whistles. Andrew Gillum is just a classy guy. Here's how he responded to that.
Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis are both scraping from the bottom of the barrel. I actually believe that Florida and its rich diversity are going to be looking for a governor who's going to bring us together, not divide us, not misogynist, not racist, not bigots. They're going to be looking for a governor who is going to appeal to our higher aspirations as a state, who is going to talk about what it means to build a Florida that makes room for all of us and not just some of us. DeSantis can do the bidding of big business and big lobbyists and Donald Trump in his divisive rhetoric. I'm going to be here to do the business of the people of the state of Florida. That's the job of the governor of this state.
Oh, yes. Now, last night, Andrew Gillum called in to, Don Lemon on CNN. And Don Lemon asked him, how'd you do it? And again, here's what Andrew Gillum said.
I think my opponents collectively spent $90 million to our six.
in this race. And, you know, we just kept, my wife refers to me as Seabiscuit. You know, we sort of were counted out at many points. People thought we would not make it, but we kept going slow and steady, retailing our way all across the state of Florida, a state of 20 million people. People didn't think we had a chance, but we did. And thanks to the outpouring of support from, again, regular, everyday working people who basically decided that they had had enough of losing. They've had enough with the status quo and that they wanted a candidate who isn't necessarily perfect, but one who reflects their values, one who reflects the everyday lived experiences of people in this state. That's what we tried to deliver. And all over this state, that message carried. What I've said to folks, again, in all parts of this state, is that that doesn't have to be a red or a blue or a purple issue. The job of the governor of the state of Florida is to do what is in the interest of all the people of the state of Florida. That's what I've
so
committed
good.
To doing. I'm a Democrat, but most importantly, I'm a Floridian who wants to build a state that has room for everybody. And that message is what we talked about throughout the primary, and we're going to double down on that into the general. And for a voter who, again, will find me not a candidate they can choose, maybe for superficial reasons, then, you know, God bless them. But my belief is that there are more voters with basic and common sense values who believe that we can do the right thing in this state and, again, win. And that's what's gotten us this far. That's what allowed for tonight's upset. And I believe that that is what is going to make me the next governor of the great state of Florida.
Oh, that's so good. I love it. I love when I listen to a candidate and I'm nodding yes. Like, yes, this is the guy we need. This is awesome. He's the real deal. Andrew Gillum. And we have a good chance of winning now. And as I said before, I think Andrew Gillum being on the ballot will help Bill Nelson. And God knows Bill Nelson needs the help. So do we in Florida. In Arizona, two female House members will square off for the Senate as Representatives Martha McSally and Kyrsten Sinema won their respective primaries, with McSally fending off right-wing crazies Kelly Ward and Joe Arpaio for the Republican nomination. In Arizona's Democratic gubernatorial primary, David Garcia, an Army veteran and education expert, won the nomination to challenge Arizona Governor Doug Ducey, giving him a chance to become the state's first Latino governor in more than 40 years. Trump stepped in it again yesterday in a private meeting with a group of evangelical Christian supporters Monday night, actually. Trump reportedly warned of violence if Democrats take control of the House of Representatives after November's midterm elections. NBC's Chuck Todd heard a recording.
Here's what the president said in a closed-door meeting with evangelical leaders last night. This is according to recorded excerpts we at NBC News have reviewed. The president warned that if the GOP loses the midterms, quote, they will overturn everything that we've done and they'll do it quickly and violently. And violently, he repeated. There's violence, he said again. When you look at Antifa and you look at some of these groups, these are violent people. The level of anger is unbelievable, he said. Part of it is because of some of the things I've done for you and for me and for my family, but I've done them. This November 6th election is very much a referendum on not only me, it's a referendum on your religion, it's a referendum on free speech, referendum on the First Amendment.
Oh, my God. So that's Chuck Todd reading what Trump said to these evangelical leaders. Look, I never had any use for organized religion before, but now this takes it to a whole new level. These people are fucking hypocrites. CNN's Jeffrey Toobin explained what Trump actually meant by that load of horseshit that came out of his mouth.
Let's be clear also about what's going on here. The theme here is, I'm Donald Trump and I'll protect you from the scary black people. Antifa is widely perceived as an African-American organization, and this is just part of the same story of LeBron James and Don Lemon and Maxine Waters and the NFL players and the UCLA basketball players. Mm-hmm. This is about black versus white. This is about Donald Trump's appeal to racism, and it just happens all the time, and we never say it. Or we don't say it enough for what it is, but that's what's going on.
And we need to call it out. And especially, look, here in Florida, if Ron DeSantis wants to be, you know, the racist in the race against a black man, and Donald Trump is his, you know, Lord and Savior, play those racist tropes down here and see how it works out for you. Because I got to tell you, it's the black people, black women who came to the rescue in the last election. Just wait. just wait. We got Andrew Gillum here. We got Stacey Abrams in Georgia and Ben Jealous in Maryland. We could have three pretty awesome black governors come November. Keep coming with the racist stuff. See how far it gets you. The governor of Puerto Rico yesterday raised the government's official death toll for Hurricane Maria following the release of a new report.
Puerto Rico's governor just moments ago revising the death toll from Hurricane Maria up to 2,975. This after an independent study was released today. You may remember the official death count up until now had been just 64 people.
I am the governor of Puerto Rico. Famous president used to say the buck stops here. So I assume whatever responsibility comes my way.
The president yesterday launched new attacks against the Silicon Valley companies that conservatives have accused of censoring right-leaning speech. In a pair of morning tweets, Trump singled out Google, accusing the search giant of promoting negative news about him and hiding favorable media coverage. He's such an asshole. He was asked about it during a press pool spray Tuesday afternoon.
The wall will be paid for very soon,
right.
By Mexico.
Sure,
it'll ultimately be paid for by Mexico.
Do you think Google should be investigated?
Yeah, I think Google is really taking advantage of a lot of people, and I think that's a very serious thing, and it's a very serious charge. I think what Google and what others are doing, if you look at what's going on at Twitter, if you look at what's going on in Facebook, they better be careful because you can't do that to people. You can't do it. We have tremendous... We have literally thousands and thousands of complaints coming in, and you just can't do that. So I think that Google and Twitter and Facebook, they're really treading on very, very troubled territory, and they have to be careful. It's not fair to large portions of the population.
Oh, my God.
Thank you very much.
Again, what a jerk he is. What a jerk. Fox News Shep Smith, once again, calls out Trump for saying things that make absolutely no sense. Oh, whoops. I need to move it in a little bit, I think.
Well, and I think that's a very serious... If you look at what's going on in Facebook...
Hold on, it's coming.
They better be careful because you're... On Facebook, they're really treading on very, very troubled territory, and they have to be careful. It's not fair to large portions of the population. Okay? Thank you very much.
Here's what Shep Smith had to say about it.
Well, Mexico will pay for the wall.
Right.
As we all know. And this new thing, today's new thing, not a thing, but a thing, Google is taking advantage of a lot of people. Google, Facebook, and Twitter, you can't do that to people.
He's reading
They're
Trump
treading
quotes.
On troubled territory.
Oh, my God.
Which means nothing.
Nothing.
John Rock, what is he talking about? treading on troubled territory? You can't do that? Do what to people?
I think what he's doing, Shep, is he's just venting. He doesn't like the coverage that he sees, particularly in the Google search results. And we pointed out some of what the president may have been either seeing on Google himself or had relayed to him. He sees a lot of Facebook postings that
and
are
I don't blame
anti
him.
His presidency. But the Twitter thing to me was a little strange.
Look,
because
let me tell you, you know, as
nobody's
one who
more
might,
prolific than him.
As one who might not like Twitter, you know, all the time for reasons that would be clearly obvious to anyone who ever went there and put my name in the thing, you know, but just part of the what he doesn't like is the news. It's not the people who are delivering it or the platforms on which they receive it. It seems to be the news itself, because around there, the news is. It's not good, except the fake news. The fake news seems to be pretty good for him. The
he
real news
it.
Seems to be unpleasant.
Yeah, you know, every once in a while, a news organization makes a fairly substantial mistake. We saw one of those over the past 24 hours. But by and large, Shep, I think he doesn't like the tone of what he sees in terms of the coverage. He doesn't like a lot of the comments that he gets on Twitter. But again, you know, nobody punches harder on Twitter than the president does. So, you know, he might not like what he sees on Google or Facebook, but I think he's got a pretty fair fight going on Twitter.
There are definitely people who punch harder, John. There are definitely that. But you know what?
I haven't met him yet.
You don't feel the punch from the Twitter. That's the thing. It's a sticks and stones kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Thick skin is required. John, thanks.
Thanks. Google,
one more time. Let me read this to you again. Mexico's paying for the wall.
No.
Google takes advantage of a lot of people.
What?
Google, Facebook, and Twitter, you can't do that to people.
What?
You're treading on some kind of territory.
Huh?
I lost the page, but you know what? It didn't make sense then. It wouldn't make sense now.
There you go. Shepard Smith still speaking truth to power from over there at Fox so-called news. He's got to have pictures of somebody doing something. That's all I can say. And one last story before we get Digby on the line. Donald Trump apparently is still talking about firing Jeff Sessions.
Brand new reporting from the Washington Post on the president's latest attempt to get rid of Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Now, you'll recall Sessions recused himself from overseeing the Russia investigation. The Post is reporting, quote, President Trump, who levied extraordinary public attacks on Attorney General Jeff Sessions in recent weeks, has privately revived the idea of firing him in conversations with his aides and personal lawyers this month, according to three people familiar with the discussions. At least twice this month, Trump vented to White House advisors and his lawyers about the, quote, endless investigation, end quote, of his campaign, and said he needs to fire Sessions for saddling his presidency with the controversy, according to two of the people.
God.
His attorneys concluded that they have persuaded him, for now, not to make such a move while the special counsel investigation of Russian interference into the 2016 presidential campaign is ongoing, the people said.
And there's your news for today. We'll get more into some of these things with Digby in just a moment. So stick around. I'm Nicole Sandler at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The Nicole Sandler Show is 100% listener supported. Have you given yet? Nicole decided not to put her show behind a paywall, knowing that many can't afford the luxury of paying for a podcast. But if you're able to, she needs your financial support to continue doing this. Consider a monthly subscription. Give when you can. Just visit NicoleSandler.com/donate. Remember, she can't do this without you.
What's that, Leonardo? Who's Nicole Sandler's next guest? Why, it's Digby, of course. Who's Digby? Observe, Leonardo. That's Dig for Dig and B for B, Digby.
Ah, an intro befitting only Heather Digby Parton. Hello, hello, Digby.
Hi, Nicole. How are you?
Oh, I'm actually doing really well today because we had a great win here in Florida last night. Andrew Gillum surprised everybody and won the primary for the Democratic nomination for governor.
I know. That couldn't be better, right? I mean, this looks like it might just change some things down there.
Yes.
Hopefully.
You know, hopefully, yeah.
Here, fingers crossed.
Because the people actually have somebody to vote for instead of just somebody to vote against, right? Because he's a real progressive. He's the real deal.
Absolutely. And, you know, and he seems to have a unique capacity to sort of bridge a lot of the divides that exist within the party. He has appeal across all sorts of lines. And, you know, I think that we were all sort of getting a little bit nervous about Bill Nelson.
Yes.
In the general election.
Mm-hmm.
And if Andrew has the kind of charisma that he seems to have and the ability to bring out all the important factions of the Democratic Party, which would include African-Americans, Hispanics, progressives, you know, and all the mainstream Democrats who are desperate to get rid of Republicans.
Yes.
And keep Ron DeSantis out of office, God help us, he could win. And I think that, I mean, I was really getting worried about Florida.
I was worried
about Nelson. I've been worried about DeSantis. So this is very good news, I think. And it's also, you know, this guy is very, very good. And he is someone who sort of, I think, has a template for maybe the future that can get us past a lot of this BS that we've been living through within the party and within the country. And so I'm very excited about it. I don't know him well. I only know what I've been seeing in the last few days and then doing a sort of cursory review, you know, months ago about mm-hmm. the Florida mm-hmm. election. So I'll be very interested to hear what you guys down there in Florida think about it as the next few weeks unfold.
Yeah, you know, I've never met him. I've been trying to get an interview with him, which hasn't come to fruition yet, but now I'll keep trying. But every time I hear him speak, I'm really impressed. He knows his shit. He's you know, down to earth. He says the right things. And everybody who knows him, you know, just speaks glowingly of him. Howie Klein knows him well and, you know, raves about him. You knew Joel Silberman,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And so mm-hmm. Joel, the last time he was on with me, I had mentioned Andrew Gillum's name, and he's like, oh, he's wonderful. I've known him for years. He's a real deal. I mean, you know, people who I highly respect.
High praise, yes.
All say great things about him. So I'm excited for once in an election year.
Well, I mean, that really is thrilling. And it's thrilling, too. I mean, as I said before, this is, you know, I mean, you and I both agree on this. I don't know. They always say it's the most important election of a lifetime. Well, this time it's actually true. It really, really is. And it's vitally important that Democrats across the board come out and vote in November. They can take with them whatever reasons they want. I won't argue with anyone on mm-hmm. why they're doing it. They just need to do it. And it's very exciting to see perhaps somebody like Andrew coming along and, you know, having that sort of inspirational thing. I think there's another race that's going on that's very exciting in the same way, which is down in Texas with Beto O'Rourke.
Yes.
Who is not the same kind of progressive that Andrew Gillum is, but Texas isn't the same kind of divided state that Florida is mm-hmm. either. So you have two different people coming at it, but both have tremendous sort of, I think what it is that they speak in a way that can appeal to people across all sorts of lines, but also that just sort of have a certain, you know, kind of values-laden, principled sort of foundation to it. You know what I mean? I mean, they just don't seem to have that same sort of focus-grouped, kind of canned, you know, approach that politicians so often have. There's something new happening there. It's happening with Democrats across the board, but particularly ones like this who are sort of coming up through the party. It's the new generation, mm-hmm. and they are approaching all this in a different way than we've seen in a very long time. And it's awfully exciting. And I would add Stacey Abrams to that
yes.
one as well in Georgia, who's running for governor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York. I mean, it's happening all over the country. There are a lot of candidates out there in this race who are just doing something different. This is not cookie cutter politics. I mean, you know, a lot of this, I think the impetus for it was the election of this monster in the White House. But what's come through is kind of a new day for the Democratic Party. And I really, you know, and that's been happening for a long time. It goes all the way, you know, back to Occupy Wall Street, mm-hmm. the Sanders campaign, all of that. A lot of feminist action, Me Too, you know, I mean, we can look at a lot of you know, various sort of influences that have brought us to this point. But it is, you know, I'm feeling hopeful, and I'm not letting myself go crazy
uh-huh.
because that would be foolish.
Right.
I think we all need to keep a little restraint on our, you know, on our assumptions here. But if the Democrats do win in November, I think, you know, we're seeing the beginnings of a more progressive and more aggressive Democratic Party, and that is good news.
Yes, I agree. And these things happen incrementally. I had a caller to the show the other day who was throwing out the old lines that, you know, the Democratic Party doesn't stand for anything, and they, you know, they're talking about is how bad Trump is. And I was like, oh, hold on a minute. You know, yes, you could have said that for a while, but right now the people that I'm looking at are saying something. All of a sudden, you have a lot of Democrats running for office under the banner of Medicare for all, $15 an hour minimum wage, tuition-free college, all these great progressive ideas and ideals that Bernie has been pushing. And now it is a platform, and you have a lot of people winning their primaries using those very points as their platform. So I don't think you can say, oh, the Democrats have no ideas anymore. The thing is, the party has to get with the progressives.
And I think that they will. I think mm-hmm. that they are. You're even seeing it in the nascent, you know, presidential campaigns that are, you know, you see all these people you know, the Kirsten Gillibrand and Cory Booker and Kamala Harris and, you know, across the board, really, even people like Joe Biden, who are, you know, thinking of running, they are all testing all this stuff out. It's clear to me. This is something that comes from the mainstream media, I think. It's that old, you know, hit on Democrats, and it absolutely drives me nuts. This idea, and they've been saying this for years, you know, the Republican Party is the party of ideas and the Democrats don't have anything. That's just nonsense. It's not true, and it's particularly not true this time. These of course, the campaigns, if they're asked by a prospective constituent what they think of Trump, they're going to say, well, we think he's terrible.
Right.
Of course they do. They're not going to deny reality. And, you know, if somebody says, are you going to investigate his crimes? Yeah, they're probably going to say, yes, we will. You know, we're going to do our job. We're
going
to do oversight. That's what we're supposed to be. That's, you know, the Republicans have abdicated their duty. They violated their oath of office. And we're not going to do that. We are going to look into all this stuff. But, of course, they have an agenda. And the agenda is very progressive, and people are responding to it. I just, you know, this is just everybody has to stop listening to that. It's, you know, between that and the idea that the Democrats are running on impeachment, which they are not.
Right.
It's the Republicans who are running on impeachment.
That's right.
Steve Bannon's out there running ads on it. You know, this is their thing. They are trying to scare their, you know, frightened, you know, old conservative voters into coming out because, you know, to save Donald Trump. It's not the Democrats who are doing that. I mean, I assume that the Democrats are going to do oversight hearings. They'll follow the evidence where it leads, but there's no agenda for impeachment. I wrote about it today in Salon magazine that you know, I would fervently love. I'd love to see him impeached in the first 2 months,
get rid of him,
and then we'll start impeaching Mike Pence.
Yes.
You know, that's fine with me.
Me too.
But I don't think that is going to happen because, first of all, investigations take time, and these Democrats are starting at square one because the Republicans haven't done jack.
Mm-hmm.
So they got to start over, and then you've got the Mueller thing coming down, and you've got all this stuff. It's not easy to impeach a president, and it could happen. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's unlikely, and it almost is impossible that he could be convicted in the Senate unless there's, you know, some kind of a bizarre shift in the way the Republicans are handling him, because they are like blind, deaf followers of Donald Trump.
That's
now,
right.
And they're not going to vote for it. So, you know, I'm not saying that I don't think he should be impeached. Of course he should be impeached. The Republicans should have impeached him, for crying out loud. But that's not what's happening here. And in the meantime, you've got Democrats who are out there actually articulating a real agenda, not some Donald Trump, you know, BS fantasy garbage.
Infrastructure
week. No basis in reality.
Right.
You know, I mean, they're out there talking about real things. And I suspect there's a hunger among the American people, all of whom, you know, anybody but a hardcore Trump voter who just votes on the basis of hatred. Everybody else is kind of going to be hungry for something real again in politics. And I think the Democrats and especially the progressives are prepared to give them that.
Oh, I definitely think so, too. And I'm wondering if, you know, the Republicans are just sort of waiting to see what happens in the midterms. I think if the damage is severe enough to the Republican brand, and it's all going to be because of Donald Trump, then maybe some of the dominoes will start falling away.
It's possible,
and it all depends on how many of us come out to vote and teach them a lesson. I think if they realize that, Donald Trump might help them win a primary race, but he's going to be poison to them in a general election, maybe some of them will try to start putting some distance between them. And maybe start looking at all the things, you know, that they should have been holding oversight hearings on all along, like we saw Axios report. I know you have it in your Salon piece today, Digby. Some of the probes that this Republican memo is predicting the Democrats will immediately launch into the minute they take control of the House. And you look at the list, and it's pretty stunning, especially when you realize that it's far from complete.
Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't believe it when I saw it. And what's even more astonishing about that list to me is that the Republicans are putting this out. Oh, look what all the Democrats are going to be looking into as soon as they take office. And what they're really saying is, look at all the stuff we've been covering up for Donald Trump and haven't even spent a minute doing oversight on. I mean, they're basically admitting their own malfeasance. It's astonishing to me, and I'm glad it's out there because I think that's something that can, you know, that should be kept in the, you know, in the archives to be pulling out every time any Republican wants to talk about, you know, oversight or talks about transparency or whatever else, because it's clear they're accomplices to what Trump is doing, all of them. They're accomplices, and they're no longer just, you know, partisans or tribalists or even cultists. They are accomplices to his crimes. They're helping him cover them up, and they're actually admitting it now in public. So, you know, I mean, I'm a big believer that one of the most important things that the Democrats have to do when they do take over, you know, one or both houses of Congress. I mean, it's a long shot for the Senate. Yep. Could happen, of course.
Yep.
You know, go Beto.
Yes.
And you know, but you know, it could happen. And if that does happen, then you know, we'll see that will change the dynamic if both houses go, because what we're going to see in the Senate, if they hold the Senate, is we're going to see people like Lindsey Graham holding competing hearings about Hillary Clinton's emails.
Yep.
I mean, that's clear to me that he's going to be the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and they're just going to launch into a counter-programming, you know, program over there. But nothing we can do about that. If we don't have the Senate, there's nothing we can do. In the House, however, we are going to have some good people running the committees, and they are going to be spending a lot of time looking into all this stuff, as they should. That's their job. They should be doing it. Meanwhile, you know, I think I can't imagine any legislation is going to pass.
No.
I'm not even sure any minimal legislation can pass, you know, like a continuing resolution to keep the government open. Yeah, I mean, I don't even think they'll name any post offices.
Right.
I can't imagine that Donald Trump is going to do that. So, you know, he's kind of asking for it. I mean, he's made it clear that he's just going to be out on the campaign trail and tweeting, watching Fox News and golfing. So I don't see any hope for any kind of real governing to happen. So, you know, he's leaving the field wide open for Democrats to just, you know, do what they need to do and hold those hearings. Let's see it. Let's see the evidence. Let's hear from, I want Don Jr. on TV testifying before the House of Representatives.
Under oath.
Yeah, you bet.
You know, a lot of the Republicans are making a big deal out of, you know, Nancy Pelosi. They've tried to cast her as the boogeyman. I think she's considered more evil among Republican circles than among Democratic circles. That being said, I know that Nancy Pelosi in her day was a very good Speaker of the House. I think it's time for her to move on. The problem has always been, you know, who's in leadership beneath her, who would come in and step up with Joe Crowley out of the picture. It doesn't mean that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez takes that slot, unfortunately. Are you seeing any other movement in the Democratic House sort of under leadership of people who might, you know, like, I'd love to see Ted Lieu step up and take a bigger role. Do you see any evidence of anybody good stepping up to try to challenge her for the speaker's position?
To be honest, I don't see that happening right now. I'll be perfectly frank. I get it, and I think that Nancy Pelosi has made a big mistake in not grooming more younger people in her leadership.
Yep.
You know, cadre to be able to step in and take over. In fairness, there were some people that she had in line, like Donna Edwards and Tim Van Hollen and others who, you know, left for various reasons to run for higher office. And that may be her fault, too. Maybe she refused to leave at a time when maybe it would have been best if she had. Mm-hmm. But I'm not making excuses. It is what it is, and it was an error on her part. A lot of people say the same thing about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You know, she
right.
should have checked out before and had Obama replace her.
Right.
So, you know, these older women, you know, by the way, unlike older men, the older women tend to be, you know, sort of held responsible for not seen the exit when they should.
That's right.
And perhaps that's true, and it should be true of people, frankly, like Joe Biden as well.
Yep.
But anyway, I think this is my prediction, and my predictions are almost always wrong, so take it with a grain of salt. But I think that what is happening, I think Nancy understands it. She's done, pretty quick now that there's nothing, that her future is short. And, you know, she is elderly, so let's mm-hmm. face it, nobody lasts forever. But I think she's totally let people go. You know, if you need to run against me, do it. You know, use uh-huh. me as your punching bag. I don't care. We have to take back the House. I do right. understand. I do believe that she understands, that they all do, that this is existential here. They have to have the House, and they have to be able to do something to stop this monster. These are the Democratic levers that we have, the Congress being the most powerful. I think that what's going to happen is, I think she will probably be challenged if the Democrats take the House. She'll be challenged for Speaker. I think she'll still probably win. People wow. like Ted Lieu are going to vote for her.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is this. There's a two-year period here. I think she's going to be putting a bunch of new people in leadership. I think that she is going to use those 2 years to groom them, number one, and mm. also that her skills as a leader in going after Trump, doing it, you know, making sure that this unfolds in a way that is, that can keep the party together. And also, you know, remember, we're going to have a presidential election starting, the day after this
oh, yes.
one, because they November go on 7th. Forever.
Yep.
So, you know, so there's a lot of competing cross currents that are going to be happening during this period. And Nancy probably is the best placed in the interim to take care of it. She's done after that. There's no doubt that in 2020, that's, you know, she'll be done by that time. But I think she's going to go another 2 years. That's my guess.
Hmm.
And then after that, I think it's over.
That
but,
makes
you know,
sense.
Hey, like I said, my predictions are always wrong. So what do I know?
Well, we'll see. What did you think about Donald Trump? So Donald Trump has a meeting at the White House with the evangelical leaders, which is the thing that that gets me the most riled
me
up.
But,
because, you know, I guess I can forgive someone. Everyone's entitled to their own beliefs. And those who, you know, have a belief in God and organized religion, more power to them. Whatever gets you through the night, I'm all for it. But these people are the biggest hypocrites on the planet. And the fact that they can stand, they can preach what they preach and stand by Donald Trump as if he's, you know, holier than now is astounding. And then he says to them, if Democrats win in November, Democrats will overturn everything that we've done, and they'll do it quickly and violently. And violently, he repeated, and violently. What? We're gonna win, and so we're gonna go out in the streets and riot?
I guess we're gonna go house to house and, you know, burn down all the Trump voters, you know, in their homes or something. I don't know what he's talking about. That makes no sense. But then, you know, when it comes to Donald Trump, very little does. You know, he's trying to gin up, you know, some kind of fear that they're gonna. You know, yeah, I mean that they're going to go burn churches or something. That Democrats are going to burn churches. I don't even know, but I do know one thing. I mean, the fact that the evangelicals are backing this guy. I mean, he was just revealed, you know, in a court of law, to have paid hush money to
yep.
a porn star and a Playboy playmate, violating campaign finance rules.
That is
true.
I
mean. You know, and here these evangelicals are all gathering. And did you read the quotes from the people at the meeting? You are the greatest, and we're just with you, and we know you're fighting for everything we believe in, and blah, blah, blah. Then you had Franklin Graham, the son of Billy Graham, coming out and going after Jeff Sessions.
Oh, my
Jeff
God.
Sessions. And saying that he is a betrayer to all they believe in because he refuses to go after Hillary Clinton for her crimes and is refusing to fire Mueller and all this stuff. I mean, I don't know. You know, I have never had a very high, you know, level of respect for these, you know, sort of professional right, you know, moral majority types.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it was always obvious to me that they were political operatives and they were also running a major con for big money. But nonetheless, I mean, this is really shocking. I mean, the only good news coming out of it is that we never have to pay attention to them again. And when the mainstream media starts, you know, when all this is over, if we survive it, and things kind of fall back into their normal grooves, as they probably will, the mainstream media is going to trot out these people on Sunday morning with Chuck Todd, and they're going to talk about morality and all this other nonsense, you know, when the Roe versus Wade case comes up to the Supreme Court. And I am, you know, I really hope that there is nobody that does anything but laugh in their face. I mean, this is absolutely ridiculous. These people are, they fashioned themselves as our moral authority for years. And, you know, look at them. And, I mean, I hate to say it, but, you know, look at the Catholic Church, too.
I know.
We got a lot.
I know.
I mean, there's a lot of institutional, instability. And I'm not sure, you know, this is the kind of stuff I think the founders, for all of their own, you know, issues, this was something I think they saw pretty clearly and understood that having religion be too involved in the affairs of state was probably not a great idea.
Right. But
mainly because these people are all political and they're also total hypocrites.
Right. But you have these same people who you know, say that they live and die by the Constitution, screaming about, you know, this is a Christian nation. No, it isn't. It explicitly is not.
I know. In fact, I mean, you know, we've got the famous Thomas Jefferson letter about the, you know, Islam and, you know, the whole thing. It's just, it's an absurdity and always has been. But it's been very difficult because, you know, in the sort of modern world where we kind of loosened up on our sort of sexual mores and women became, you know, more free and equal in society, you know, they were out there preaching this traditional values crapola, and everybody was kind of felt like they had to listen to them, right? Well, they're the religious people, and they have, you know, they're the values voters, right? I mean, they even have the nerve to call themselves that. And, you know, there was always this sort of tension there within our culture between those people who were trying to, you know, promote traditional values and the rest of us who were saying, hey, you know, how about a little equality? How about getting rid of, you know, patriarchy? How about racism? You know, all this stuff. And honestly, I think they've just destroyed themselves now. I mean, how could anyone listen to them after Trump? You can't. I mean, they have nothing to stand on after this. And they're out there vocally doing it. It's not like they're doing it on the sly or kind of, they're not being even remotely clever in trying to maintain some kind of, you know, principled stance. They're just out there. We love Trump. We don't care. Yeah, we're fine with him. He's absolutely okay with us, you know.
Which
love him.
Is mind-blowing. I feel like I need to get one of the, you know, like Frank Schaefer back on the show again and say, how do they justify this to their God?
Right. Explain this to me, please. I know. I don't know. I don't, you know, but, you know, I feel that way kind of, Nicole, about our society in general. I mean, this experience of Donald Trump, I mean, you know, we always knew this stuff existed, right? I mean, that racism, sexism, you know, all the sort of hypocrisy, you know, it's Harper Valley PTA, right? I mean, this stuff has always sort of been around. But this just throwing off any pretense to, you know, some kind of standards. I mean, even if you just look at what Trump's done with McCain. I mean, I'm no McCain fan.
Horrible.
I haven't been eulogizing him as a great man. I mean, you look at my blog over the past 15 years, you'll find a lot of really, really harsh you know, evaluations of the McCain legacy. But having said that, look, the guy just died. He's got a family. He had, you know, served the country for many years.
Yep.
Maybe not in a way I would have preferred, but he did do that. The idea that the president of the United States just is acting like a petulant child over the political battle that the two of them had, and that his people are all backing him up on it. Yeah, that's great. After McCain had been held up and thrown in our face for years in that sort of love it or leave it, these colors don't run phony patriotism they love to you know, trot out every 5 minutes. And you know, this idea that we've gotten to a point, really, where the Republicans don't even, they can't even pull themselves together for a few days to you know, kind of honor somebody like John McCain, who's been a Republican since forever and a POW and all of that. I mean, just what happened to these people?
Well,
I mean,
they got
I have this theory going, and I'd be interested to see what you think of it. I haven't written about it, but I plan to. That this is their Woodstock. This is them just kind of throwing out their clothes and rolling around in the mud and dropping acid and listening to Jimi Hendrix. This is that part of the baby booms, you know, the ones that, you know, the dipshits. They've always been out there, too, just like the people at Woodstock. This other side's always been there. And you know, this is them. They've been waiting their whole lives for this moment to just let it all hang out and let their freak flag fly.
Maybe.
And that's what they're doing. I mean, I don't know.
Right.
I can't explain it any
other way.
Or
maybe they're, you know, this is their, he is their Antichrist, and they're trying to bring on the apocalypse. Which,
well, there's that too.
You know, which a lot of them, I wouldn't put it past them. That's what they want.
Absolutely.
They want all us Jews to return home to Israel, and they want the world to end so they can be raptured.
Yep.
And you know, if there ever was an Antichrist kind of figure, they kept saying it was Obama. I think Trump, you know, more closely fits it. Anyway, Digby, it's always great talking to you. We're just out of time. It goes by way too fast. Thank you so much for joining us. I always appreciate
it. My pleasure, Nicole. Talk to you soon.
Okay, you take care. Bye.